Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source, grassroots, and partially solar-powered community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, debtors' traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get some notebook, paper, and pen so you can take notes during the show. First, we look at some debt-related news and facts for the week. From Bloomberg.com, credit history for insurance, hiring eyed by Congress. This was by Margaret Collins. Congress is examining the use of consumer credit history by employers to make hiring decisions or insurers to set premiums, said U.S. Representative Luis Gutierrez, an Illinois Democrat. Credit scores and reports are used by insurance companies to pick their customers and are used to exclude those most likely to file a claim, said Gutierrez in a statement, whose Subcommittee on Financial Institutions and Consumer Credit held a hearing in Washington on the issue. We are watching very closely and will take action if and when we find their practices out of line, he said. Lenders use credit scores, such as the one developed by Minneapolis-based FICO, as a measure of credit worthiness in providing credit cards, mortgages, and auto loans. Insurance companies use the scores to predict the likelihood of a claim, and employers may check credit reports when hiring to determine how honest an employee may be, said Liz Pullman Weston, author of Your Credit Score. Nearly half of employers use credit reports in employment decisions, according to the National Consumer Law Center, a nonprofit based in Boston. Credit checks in hiring discriminate against African American and Latino job applicants and don't predict job performance, said Chi-Chi Wu, a staff attorney for the Law Center. It's harmful and unfair to American workers, Wu said at the hearing. Credit reports may contain errors and may be compromised by identity theft, according to the Law Center. Unemployed individuals may also fall behind on bills and have difficulty getting a job to help pay off debts because employers consider their credit history, Wu said. The unemployment rate rose to 9.9% in April from 9.7% the prior month, according to the Department of Labor. Congressional representatives, including Gutierrez, pressed witnesses on how credit history helps determine the likelihood of a driving accident or property damage. Gutierrez said he wondered how someone being unemployed and falling behind on bills would make the person a higher risk for a fire in their home. There's a very strong relationship between good credit and how much individuals may cost an insurance company, said Weston in an interview. The concern is whether the information will be used to discriminate against those with low incomes as well as minorities who may have lower scores, she said. About 90% of individual insurers use credit information in their risk assessment and pricing, said David Snyder, Vice President and Associate General Counsel at the American Insurance Association, an industry trade group based in Washington. The use of credit information is already heavily regulated and has proven to be very important for the market, Snyder said. It predicts the likelihood of having a claim, Snyder continued, and has helped companies insure more people because companies can assess individual risk. 48 states regulate the use of credit scores for insurance, said Michael McRaith, director of the Illinois Department of Insurance. Typically, states will not allow credit-based insurance scores to be used as the sole basis for increasing rates or denying, canceling, or non-renewing policies, he said. Credit information can benefit borrowers and individuals seeking policies such as property and casualty insurance because those with higher scores generally receive better terms, Weston said. Representative Mary Jill Kilroy, an Ohio Democrat, introduced a bill that would prohibit medical debt paid off as a criteria in determining a consumer's credit worthiness. State insurance laws vary on whether consumers can be penalized for medical debt, McRaith said. A bill introduced last summer by Representative Steve Cohen, a Tennessee Democrat, would prohibit the use of consumer credit checks on employees for employment decisions. Senator Dianne Feinstein, a California Democrat, introduced an amendment on May 4th to the financial reform bill that would generally ban the practice. Again, those are points from Margaret Collins in New York for Bloomberg.com. And from the New York Times, the New York Attorney General has started an investigation of 8 banks to determine whether they provided misleading information to rating agencies in order to inflate the grades of certain mortgage securities, according to 2 people with knowledge of the investigation. The agencies themselves have been widely criticized for overstating the quality of many mortgage securities that ended up losing money once the housing market collapsed. The inquiry by Attorney General of New York Andrew Cuomo suggests that he thinks the agencies may have been duped by one or more of the targets of his investigation. Those targets are Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, UBS, Citigroup, Credit Suisse, Deutsche Bank, Credit Agricole, and Merrill Lynch, who is now owned by Bank of America. The companies that rated the mortgage deals are Standard & Poor's, Fitch Ratings, and Moody's Investor Service. Investors use their ratings to decide whether to buy mortgage securities. And from MSNBC.com by Bob Salzberg, for decades, the Oaks was the Oceanside playground of the Barons and the Bancrofts, heirs to the Dow Jones and Wall Street Journal fortunes. This week, the 20,000-square-foot mansion with 45 rooms and surrounding properties went on sale with an asking price of $55 million. The listing, which included a marina, restaurant, and the Cohasset Harbor Inn, is hardly intended for the casual buyer. People move here and don't move away too quickly, said agent Jonathan Radford of Coldwell Banker Residential Brokerage. For more than a century and a half, only 3 families have called the 9.4-acre property about 20 miles south of Boston their home. The first was Lawrence Barrett, a 19th-century actor who played Othello opposite Edwin Booth Iago and served as a captain in the Civil War. The second owner was Clarence Barron, a Bostonian who purchased Dow Jones and Company for $130,000 in 1902 and is credited with transforming the Wall Street Journal into the financial journalism powerhouse it has remained through present day. He later founded Barron's Magazine and was its first editor. Barron's stepdaughter married into another prominent Boston family, the Bancrofts, who became heirs to Dow Jones and the publishing empire. 2 years after Barron's death in 1928, the Bancrofts razed the original estate and replaced it by the current ivy-covered Georgian Revival mansion. Barron's granddaughter, Jessie Bancroft Cox, lived in the home until her death in 1982. Yankee Oil and Gas briefly owned the estate before it was purchased by the current owner, Peter Roy, in 1989. Roy, a private man who describes himself as a former energy company owner and retired investor, is selling the estate to move to Toronto with his Canadian-born wife and 3 children. Radford, the real estate agent, said he has no idea how long the Oaks will stay on the market. He can't even guess if the property will be there for 1 day or 2 years. We don't know if the buyer will come from Cohasset or Singapore, he said, adding that Roy, as a practical businessman, would consider selling pieces of the property separately or to multiple buyers. So if you're interested, get in touch with Jonathan Radford at the Coldwell Banker Residential Brokerage in Boston. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. And the latest series in my shows has been the opportunity to learn from the two-income trap, why middle-class parents are going broke, by Elizabeth Warren and Amelia Warren Tyagi. And I start with an important credit because the thoughts, ideas, examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of Professor Elizabeth Warren from Harvard and her daughter Amelia Warren Tyagi, two of America's leading champions for debtors. I highly recommend their books, All Your Worth and The Two Income Trap. And you can also visit the Archives for Life and Debt at www.kruufm.com, and you could listen to and learn from all of the shows that have been produced in this series. Last week, from the Two Income Trap, we were talking about the debt explosion. In the world of unregulated lending, families are barraged with advertisements and offers for new products, which is all the debt they could ever want and more. And as I mentioned, there are 5 billion pre-approved credit card offers each year, totaling over $350,000 of credit per family pouring into the mailboxes all across America. Even with the current financial bust, I have 5 right here on my desk that were sent to my wife, trying to lure her into getting more credit. Of course, the reason they're on my desk and not on her desk is because she's smart and does not want to get lured into this quagmire. And I generally use these as paper for our wood stove. And it's not just in the snail mail that these come. They're in magazine ads, telephone calls, masses of emails, and even flyers at the bottom of grocery store bags. I also pointed out that your college-age students are being stalked by credit card marketers across campuses, in local shopping malls, and often by their own classmates who are hired to try to sell credit. As a result, credit card debt has increased accordingly from less than $10 billion in 1968, inflation adjusted, to more than $600 billion in 2000 and almost $900 billion for revolving debt alone in the current year. That's a jump from $10 billion to almost 9,000% increase. So it seems that once Americans got a bite at the debt apple, they just couldn't get enough. But Professor Warren asked the rational question, what are the families spending all the money on? Did they blow it on vacations and luxury items, as is often claimed? She says that this explanation gratifies the self-righteous bill payers, but it doesn't square with the facts. Undoubtedly, all that easy credit dangling under everyone's noses enticed a few more Americans into buying things they could have lived without, no doubt. And what people are buying may have shifted to computers and electronic devices for communication, but according to the statistics Professor Warren gathered, people are actually spending less on food, clothing, appliances, home furnishings, and tobacco, a lot less than a generation ago. There is no evidence of increases in impulse buying or luxury acquisitions over the past 40 years, certainly nothing that could account for a 9,000% increase in credit card debt. The expenditures that have shown the biggest increases are housing, health insurance, college tuition, and preschool, which, when you think about it, are the purchases least likely to appear on a credit card bill. Well, if families aren't buying more goods, then what are they using all that debt for? Professor Warren and Amelia say they got into debt trying to buy their way out of the two-income trap. First, the bidding war has inflated the cost of middle-class life to a point that once they have paid the mortgage and other fixed expenses, families have little discretionary income left, and even less for margin of error. Now, just to refresh your memory, the bidding war has to do with the cost increase of housing by people moving into neighborhoods with better schools for the children. Professor Warren's statistics show that this is massive, and it has been overlooked by most analysts. Of course, we've discussed this in prior shows, and you could go back and listen to those. But because people are paying more of a percentage of their income for their home, with so little margin for error, what can people do when something goes wrong, as it increasingly does in the current economy? In sum, since the two-income family does not have a stay-at-home mom to call on to help make ends meet, when emergency strikes, the family turns to debt to make it through the next payday. The use of credit cards becomes very helpful for even basics. The other thing that people do is they take a second mortgage out on their home to deal with this kind of debt. Health insurance, college tuition, preschool, money not flowing into the house for all kinds of things that are necessaries. They even take that second mortgage just to pay down their credit card bills and their medical debt, making secured debt to pay for unsecured debt, which is not a very wise thing to do. And as we noted in the past, it gets so bad for some people that they file bankruptcy, and nearly 90% had to file bankruptcy because they lost a job, they had a medical problem, or a family breakup, or some combination of all three. And in conclusion, Professor Warren says that people are actually responding in a rational, reasonable, human way to dealing with unforeseen problems. Of course, they spent the money and couldn't pay it back. They had to file bankruptcy, but their overspending was for medical care they could not afford, or keeping up with child support payments with leaving too little left over to pay for the rent, and perhaps trying to hold on to their homes and cars even after they lost their jobs. Not very many people will pay their MasterCard and Visa bills if it means not feeding their children or instantaneously leaving their home and moving into a shelter because they can't meet a mortgage payment. She says that only the willfully ignorant refuse to acknowledge the real reasons behind all the debt. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So continuing with the two-income trap, we look at the concept of mortgaging the future. We talked about the interest rate deregulation and how it dovetailed neatly with a seemingly unrelated phenomenon, which is the bidding war for suburban housing. The mortgage industry shook off its interest rate regulations just a few years after the credit card industry, and we had quite a long time of unfettered mortgage lending where the middle class family was no longer restricted to the conventional 80% mortgage. This opened floodgates. Families could get all the mortgage money they ever dreamed of to bid on that precious home in the suburbs, even if the price tag was more than they could realistically afford. Competition for homes in good neighborhoods has always been stiff, and overloading on mortgage debt to purchase a better home has long posed a temptation for young families. Now, a generation ago, it simply wasn't possible to give in to that temptation. Mortgage lenders didn't allow it. But that game shifted, and became quite different. It became routine for lenders to issue unmanageable mortgages. We know that housing expense should be approximately 25 to 28% of the gross monthly income, but for many people, it's at least 40% of their earnings, which is considered house poor, spending so much on the housing that they jeopardize their overall financial security. Professor Warren says that saying they are house poor really doesn't mean that they're poor at all, because many middle-class families actually overextended themselves in a desperate effort to find a home in the midst of a fearsome bidding war. This happened over the past generation, which at the same time, millions of households sent a second earner into the workforce. So, the proportion of middle-class families that would be classified as house poor or near poor has quadrupled at the time of the turn of the century. The down payment, once a critical device for screening potential borrowers, virtually disappeared. We know back in the day, 1970s, first-time home buyers put down, on average, 18% of the purchase price in order to get a mortgage. Today, that has shrunk to just 3% and even 0% in some of the exotic mortgage packages that have been offered. It can sound appealing, but it has an ominous side. Now, the family that can't come up with a down payment pays higher points and fees, and many are forced by the lenders to purchase additional credit insurance. They get those mortgages that they could not have gotten a generation ago, but they pay a lot more for them. And as we saw, families that didn't make down payments were more likely to lose their homes, which was why the traditional lenders required the 20% down payment in the first place. One study showed that families that make a down payment of less than 5% of the purchase price are 15 to 20 times more likely to default than those who put down 20% or more. Professor Warren's recommendation is to impose some standards in the mortgage market, but we know that deregulation continued and actually in some real respects continues to reign supreme, because nothing substantial has actually occurred. The mortgage foreclosure rates are still escalating, and all the talk on the modifications and the reality of that are frankly illusory, according to all my colleagues across the country. Banks are given discretion to go over paperwork for mortgage modifications, but the truth is those modifications do not really change the bottom line for even the handful of people that get them. So millions of people are losing their chance at staying in their homes. Again, Professor Warren points out, as regulatory control over interest rates collapsed, a new industry was born, the subprime mortgage lender. We've seen all of the horrific fallout from that. The subprime lender specialized in issuing high-interest mortgages to families with spotty credit who were unlikely to qualify for traditional low-cost prime mortgages. But it was actually more nefarious than that, because many of the people who could qualify for low-cost traditional prime mortgages were steered into subprime mortgages, particularly African Americans and Latinos. Also, elderly people were hit by this attack on refinancing in particular, and the equity in their homes was skimmed. In the early days of deregulation, subprime mortgage lending was unheard of, but by the mid-1990s, banking giants such as Chase, Manhattan, and Citibank, which made huge profits from credit card lending, were looking for new markets to tap. So they applied the same principle to home mortgage lending that had profited their credit card division so handsomely. Charge high interest rates, and sell, sell, sell. To give a sense of just how expensive subprime mortgages are, in 2001, when standard mortgage loans were in the 6.5% range, Citibank's average mortgage rate, which included both subprime and traditional mortgages, was 15.6%. So in perspective, a family buying a $175,000 home with a subprime loan at 15.6% would pay an extra $420,000 during the 30-year life of the mortgage. That is over and above the payments due on a prime mortgage. Had that family gotten a traditional mortgage instead, they would have been able to put two children through college, purchase half a dozen new cars, and put enough aside for a comfortable retirement. This is the reality of subprime lending. Now, we heard the arguments. Citibank, Chase, and other subprime lenders typically defended their business practices by arguing that they were helping more families own their homes. But Professor Warren says this is little more than a public relations hot air. In the overwhelming majority of cases, subprime lenders prey on families that already own their homes rather than expanding access to new homeowners. Fully 80% of subprime mortgages involve refinancing loans for families that already own their home. 80%. For these families, subprime lending does nothing more than increase the family's housing costs, taking away resources from other investments, and increasing the chances that the family will lose its home if anything went wrong. And we see that lots has gone wrong. Subprime lending has an even more pernicious effect. It ensnares people who, in a regulated market, would have had access to low-cost mortgages. As I mentioned before, lenders' own data show that many of the families that end up in the subprime market are middle-class families that would typically qualify for a traditional mortgage. Going back on Citibank, for example, researchers concluded that at least 40% of those who were sold ruinous subprime mortgages would have qualified for prime rate loans. 40%. Nor is the Citibank an isolated case. A study by the Department of Housing and Urban Development revealed that 1 in 9 middle-class families and 1 in 14 upper-income families who refinanced a home mortgage ended up with a high-fee, high-interest subprime mortgage. For many of these families, there is no trade-off between access to credit and the cost of credit. They had their pockets picked, plain and simple. You may ask, why would a middle-class family take on a high-interest mortgage if they could qualify for better deals? The answer, quite simply, is that they didn't know they could do any better. Many unsuspecting families are steered into an overpriced mortgage by a broker or some other middle person who represents himself as acting in the borrower's best interest, but who is actually taking big fees and commissions from subprime lenders. In some neighborhoods, these brokers went door to door, acting as bird dogs for lenders, looking for unsuspecting homeowners who might be tempted by the promise of extra cash. Other families got broadsided by extra fees and hidden costs that didn't show up until it was too late to go to another lender. One industry expert describes the phenomenon. Mrs. Jones negotiates an 8% loan, and the paperwork comes in at 10%. And the loan officer or broker says, "Don't worry, I'll take care of that. Just sign here." This is all just a small example of what happened to create this mortgage disaster. And we will continue next week. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life in Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.